I'm Michelle, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Denise. I'm really, really grateful to be here tonight. I'm really nervous, but I'm really grateful. Like Denise said, David and I are relatively new to this area. We moved up here from South Florida last year, where we both had extremely very tight-knit recovery networks that we were involved with down there. So close that when we moved up here, we looked for meetings before we looked for a place to live, because we were that convinced. We had no reservations. We knew we needed meetings. We needed sponsors. We needed to try to find a new place to fit in and get the fellowship that we knew was what was saving our lives, along with this program. And we've been really blessed in what we found so far up here, and just the amazing strength, the amount of sobriety, the quality, and everything has just been really amazing. And so I feel really happy to be part of a new community and to understand and know that this truly is something that is vast as the world, you know, and it makes me feel like I have some place that I can belong where I don't have to be afraid. As I was overthinking what I was going to say tonight, I decided to read stories in the Big Book, and I was looking on WeJoy and different things, and it struck me that all these stories are so the same, you know, and so different but so the same, which gave me a really good feeling, because I knew that if I prayed today for something to come out that hopefully would be able to give somebody else hope, that it was going to come, and that I was not terminally unique, and I didn't. It took off a lot of the pressure, but I did find something that stuck out to me when I was doing a literature lead about a year ago down in Florida, and I came across it today, and so I wanted to start with this and then lead into my story, and this is from the story Stars Don't Fall. My alcoholic problem began long before I drank. My personality from the time I can remember anything was the perfect setup for an alcoholic career. I was always at odds with the entire world, not to say the universe. I was out of step with life, with my family, with people in general. I tried to compensate with impossible dreams and ambitions, which were simply early forms of escape. Even when I was old enough to know better, I dreamed about being as beautiful as Venus, as pure as the Madonna, and as brilliant as the President of the United States is supposed to be. I had writing ambitions, and nothing would do but that I'd like to write like Shakespeare. I'd also wanted to be the queen of society, with a glittering salon, the bride of a dream prince, the mother of a happy brood. Inside, I went right on being a mass of unlovely self-pity, queasy anxiety, and sickening self-debasement. Naturally, I succeeded at nothing. Until I reached AA, my life was a shambles. I was a mess, and I made everybody near and dear to me miserable. I had to go through extreme alcoholism to find my answer. And for me, this has a lot of meaning, because I don't know when I took my first drink. I'm not really sure, but I know when I went to my first AA meeting, and that was in 1985. So in a lot of the reflection I've been doing lately, and going back and doing the jail meetings and things like that, and having had that experience and being able to share, I had prior this idea that once I went to treatment, that step one, two, and three came real quickly for me, until I thought about the fact that my first meeting was in 1985, which now tells me that I made a choice not to take step one, and decided that what would be a great idea would be to continue for 30 years trying to prove how powerful I was, because I was not ready to learn that. Thank God, by the grace of God, I was able to make it back to this program. My sobriety date is July 21st of 2016, so by the grace of God, in about a month, I'll have 2 years, which I never, never would have thought was possible. But the level that I had to get to, what I had to go through to learn that I was powerless, for me, it had to take a long period. It had there's a very thick skull that needed a lot of mallets hitting it before I was able to see that. And with that particular story, Stars Don't Fall, I like what it says about the personality, because it reminds me that the drinking is really just a manifestation of my thinking problem. Because I did have all of those ideas, those delusions of grandeur when I was little about it, and I even was encouraged by my mom in some ways, saying, you know, you're so smart, you're so pretty, you can do anything, you can be anything. And I took that to a whole nother level, because what it meant to me was I don't have to be myself, because I don't even know who myself is. And those masks, I was the oldest grandchild. I was the favorite a lot of the time, and those masks started coming out for me very, very early. Of, you know, I was Michelle, the smart, the great student, and then I was Michelle, the cheerleader, and I was Michelle, whatever it was, you know, whatever I thought I could be. And at that point, I really thought it was because I could do anything. I didn't realize it was because I really didn't know what I wanted, and what I really was not good enough, ultimately. Like I said, I really don't remember when I started drinking, but I do remember that I drank alcoholically from the very beginning. And I don't ever remember drinking not to get drunk, or most of the time I blacked out, and those were from where I was really, really young. I remember being like 13 or 14 and my mom telling me a story of a time when she got a phone call about how much I had drank to please come pick me up, and that she listened to me breathe all night because she thought I was gonna die. And that was when I was really young. Which led me into my first treatment center at the age of 15, when I went to the first AA meeting that I had spoken about prior. And that was an intervention that was set up by my family, my dad, who June 13th celebrated 47 years in this program, and his sponsor, and then along with my family, had set up this treatment opportunity, which what I decided to do with that was, it, being the fantastic intellectual that I am, was to learn exactly what I could do to manipulate my way into not letting anybody know what was going on with me for many years to come, and to try to outsmart the program and really think that I was something. I was going to beat the odds, and I was going to be the person who defied those odds, because I saw myself not as somebody who was off the deep end or insane. I saw myself as extreme. That's how I labeled myself. I was very, very extreme, and I listened to extreme music and did extreme things and did extreme traveling, and it led me to choose jobs where I could fit in really easily with people that were doing the same behavior as me. So I started off working in the music industry. And I traveled all over the country and promoted clubs and promoted bands and hardcore music. And I fit right in there, boy. You know, I thought that was just the life for me, because everybody, you know, I brought everybody their shots and their beers, and everybody liked me because I was going right along with the crowd, and I didn't look so bad in that group of people because we were all doing it, you know. And little by little, that got less attractive. It got less cute, and the bands that I was supposed to be managing didn't appreciate so much when I couldn't remember where the money for their merchandise was, or where, you know, or when we were supposed to leave in the morning and I was at some party. This is before cell phones, so they couldn't get in touch with me because I had left with somebody from the show and was in a different state, and they had, you know, and we were falling behind schedule when we were touring and things like that. So it started to not go quite as planned. So at some point around then, I decided that what would be a great idea, I should go back to school, because I thought, well, I'm spending too much time in strip clubs, I'm spending too much time with all this kind of thing. I'll go back to school, because it's not me, it's just that I need to, you know, I need to take another step. So by this time, by the way, I had already, I think, had two DUIs, which I managed to do the first two before I was 21. I went back to school, got a degree in business management, and was deciding, I had been working as a bartender, another great job for an alcoholic, and in the restaurant industry, and right when I was getting ready to graduate from college, I unfortunately got another DUI. And I had already decided I was going to get out of restaurants. I was, you know, I was not going to be doing that anymore. And then here comes the DUI. And so I decided to get a job managing the restaurant that I was working in as a server at that time because I had the experience. I could do it. And I was scared. I didn't know at this point it was going to be number three. I didn't know if I was going to jail, what was going to happen. So that led me into that. And that started a whole nother group of people, you know, I was everybody's favorite manager because, of course, I let everybody stay after work and drink with me or drink with me during work or whatever else we were doing during work and got, you know, I mean, I was the most popular one, again, until it became a situation where it wasn't so attractive to see your boss falling off the chair at the end of the night or not able to run a shift because you're outside vomiting in the trash can while you're trying to cook food for other people to come and eat or things like that. Not so great. So that was just pretty much how I lived, and I chose those kind of jobs, and it went on and went on. And at that point, somewhere around then, I got married. I think at that point I had decided that I wasn't going to drink for a little while only because of that DUI. So I had, and I was afraid to go to jail. I had met somebody who had a prior history with substance abuse, and knowing full well, you know, we both happened to be sober at that point, but knowing full well where that would probably lead, decided to go for it and got married within 6 months and went down that path. And that ensued a good 6-year run of continuous drinking and all the things that come along with it in a relationship where drinking is the number one thing and you don't remember and there's a lot of abuse, much of it brought on by me. I was oftentimes the aggressor. I was very angry by that point and still drinking as a blackout drinker, so I didn't remember a lot of the time, and I was becoming more and more violent. And things like that. We started trying to do the thing of geographical, you know, moving. We moved from Colorado to New Mexico, and then we moved from New Mexico to Texas, and then we moved back, you know, from Texas back to New Mexico. All the time, I would say probably during that period, if there were 10 days that we didn't drink from morning to night, that would probably be a high estimate. It was pretty much by then an all day, everyday cheap vodka kind of a thing. There wasn't much glamour left in it. It had quit being fun a real long time ago. Part of my story and part of what what led me to my bottom is a really tragic story. At this point, we were living up in Taos, New Mexico. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Taos, New Mexico, but it's a beautiful, wonderful place. It's, people go there, you know, to visit. It's a very spiritual place. It's got a lot of really cool stuff. And I was managing a place which was a music venue / bar / restaurant. So everything all in one. And a real small police department. So I had that going for me. And, you know, just still doing the drinking every day. And my husband, who prior had issues with different substances, had become equally the same drinker that I was. And in fact, had said to me on more than one occasion that this was far worse than anything else he had ever done. He experienced all of the physical issues, things that I was lucky. I never really had the physical issues quite as much as he did, but it had progressed, really progressed strongly for him. And on Labor Day of 2014, he had made his third attempt to go in to try to get treatment. Now, how hard we were really trying, I won't say we were trying that hard, because obviously if you want help bad enough, you'll find it, especially when you've got a dad that's been sober as long. I mean, we used excuses, clearly. That he went in to get treatment, came out, totaled my car, we proceeded to go to the liquor store, and we were both crying that day. I remember saying, we can't live like this anymore. I had been having an impending sense of doom for probably nearly 2 years. Not knowing exactly what it was, but knowing that it was alcohol. It was always alcohol based in my life. My whole life, every problem was somehow somehow related to alcohol. There was not a time really that I got in trouble that I wasn't drinking. It was always that problem. And that day, as we proceeded to drink ourselves into oblivion, my husband took his own life as a result of this disease. And I was too drunk to be able to help him, to be able to stop him. Not that I'm that powerful, but in my mind, I thought I was. And that was a direct result of this disease and where it can take you. And what I think is an emotional death. After that, I really believed that was what the reason for the impending doom had been. I was going to make a decision to not drink anymore, and I meant it. You know, when I told my family at that point, this is clearly he gave his life, he lost his life so that I could have mine back, and I meant that. I really did. I thought it can't get any worse than this. And for about 8 months, I was able to not drink. I wasn't sober, but I didn't drink. And I did all kinds of other things to distract myself. I did other things for my family. My stepdaughter had been living with us at the time and had decided to stay with me. I put everything into her, tried to get her help, tried to do this, tried to do that, which worked out great for a while. And in the following April, I started drinking. It was one day, one thought, I started drinking again. And that led me off on the worst year and a half ever that I went on. Because at that point, like it says in the big book, I knew how bad I was. I knew that all those things that I had thought about myself were clearly true. Because how could a person lose that and go through that and then turn around and go against everything? You know, that was like a slap in his face in my mind. And I was at the point where I was really even more than ever drinking alone, hiding things, hiding from my family, isolating from my family, making it look like anybody who saw what I was doing was lying. And I was good at that. I mean, I was the master manipulator. I was a master liar. I didn't even know what the truth was anymore. And I ended up meeting another person, getting into another relationship. And this person was actually a pretty nice guy. Unfortunately, as hardcore of an alcoholic as I was. And one night when we were drinking together, which was, it has been 2 years, as of June 11th, he died on the floor while I was drunk. And I woke up and found him in the middle of the hallway, physically dead from this disease. So that was within the period of 2 years. And I share that because it's part of my story, not because I want to dwell on horror stories. We've all got that. The reason why it sticks out to me, there's a couple reasons. One, it makes me see how unimportant I was to myself and how it took that. I was not important enough to stop for, not to me. I had to see something else in order for me to really be able to see, have the gratitude that I have today for my own life, for being able to wake up every day. And I also choose to believe that we need guardian angels of all shapes and sizes and ages. My husband was 10 years younger than me, 35 at the time that happened. Really young. The older we get, the younger that seems. And my other significant other was 46, really young. I'm glad that wasn't me. It gives, you know, every day when let me back up a little bit. About a month after that happened, I the one thing I had kept a hold of the whole time since the meeting when I was 15 years old was a serenity prayer. And I said it a lot. I didn't know really what it meant, and I really only thought of the first part as far as grabbing the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. So I used it mostly to enhance my victimization of myself, I think. But I said it. I mean, I said it, and in what I knew, what limited spiritual experience I had at that time, I meant it. And one night I was praying that prayer drunk. And this was in July of 2016, early July, right around my birthday. And for some reason, I picked up the phone and I called my dad, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I said, Dad, I need to come to Florida for treatment. And please don't let me make any excuses, because I had been going back and forth for a little while on what I was going to do. And they were all trying. I mean, my family by this time was, of course, horrified, seeing what I was doing, thinking probably I would be next. You know, it was coming. And my dad and the rest of my family had me on a plane to Florida within 48 hours. I was there, and I was in detox. And I was ready at that point. I was broken, and I had the gift of desperation. I definitely had the gift of desperation. And I thought, as I've gone through the process over the past 2 years, I really thought that I picked up step 1, 2, and 3 real quick, because I was like, yeah, boy, when I got into treatment, I had 1, 2, and 3, and I was good to go, until I thought about the fact that it had been 30 years, and then I was like, maybe I wasn't as teachable as I thought I was all those years. It took what it took for me. You know, my bottom needed to be where my bottom was. And, you know, my dad has told me since that he had had conversations with my mom when my mom was trying to say, what should we do with her? What, you know, she's going to die, this or that. My dad said he told my mom, you can't deny her of her bottom. You know, she's got to do what she has to do. And about a year ago, I got to speak with my dad at a meeting, and what he said was, for anybody out there who has a child struggling with this disease, don't ever give up, because he waited 30 years for that phone call, but it came. You know what I mean? And as I went through that treatment center, when I got in there, there was probably nothing that anybody could have told me that I would not have done. I knew, even though I didn't know why or what any of it meant, I knew that if I continued how I was, how I didn't get another DUI, I have no idea. How I didn't kill somebody else on the road, I have no idea. How I ended up without any physical maladies because of this, no diabetes, no liver, no issues, I have no idea, but boy was I grateful. I mean, it brought it got me through some of the fear, just seeing that that's a miracle. To me, those things are all miracles. And my mom told me for years and years, Michelle, God's riding shotgun with you. And I never knew exactly what she meant until I started to develop my own relationship with God. But boy, he was, because apparently I've got a purpose. Still trying to figure out exactly what that is, but there's got to be something, because the odds were definitely no longer in my favor. Definitely not. And this past 2 years have been just, I've had so many blessings, so many things that have been part of my experience. I was very lucky in the fact that I still had my family. My family still believed in me. They may not have trusted me, and they may have thought I was lying, but they didn't want me to die. They didn't want that. They still loved me, and they still were behind me. And that's one of the things I saw quickly in treatment, was that I was definitely one of the people that was on the lucky end of that spectrum, because there were a lot of girls I was in an all-women's facility, and I would say 90% of those women did not have anybody. They had lost everybody. Nobody supported them. And they didn't have the visitors or the family or, you know, the people sending them anything, or phone calls, anybody that wanted to talk to them. I was lucky. I had that stuff. And one of the things we did every morning was we did our daily readings, and we did our gratitude list, and we said it out loud. And at first I didn't get it. I was like, what do I have to be great? I mean, what am I grateful for? And that's all I could say at that point. I'm grateful to be alive, and I'm grateful for my family. Those two things I knew, because I could be grateful for those things. And I could see that with what was going on around with me, that there was some hope, and that maybe, just maybe, it could maybe work for me too. And I was willing to believe that. I mean, I was willing to believe it, because I was still alive. And I found a sponsor who had gone through my same treatment facility. She had 18 years. And she was a great first sponsor for me. She knew what the process of that treatment center was, so she was able to kind of, she was my AA guru, but she also understood that for some of the trauma that I had experienced in my specific case, I needed a little bit of other things to go along with that. And she got that, you know, and she was strict about how we went through things, but she also gave me the time when it came to my fourth and fifth step and things like that to really let me get out. I needed to be thorough. Now, in hindsight, looking back, maybe I didn't need to be quite so thorough because it took me 6 months to do it. But I got out things and said the truth about things finally to one person. And for me, that was the most important thing because I didn't even know who I had lied to about what anymore. I didn't know. And with her, I remember at one point she told me, now, Michelle, if there's things that you don't think you can share with me, we can find somebody else. And I said, hell no, no. I'm telling you all of it. I need to tell somebody everything so that you'll be the one person that can call me on stuff when I'm lying. You know what I mean? And I might lie without even knowing that I'm lying at this point. I'm not sure. And that was important at that point. And, we came up to Georgia. When we came up to Georgia, I was just working on step 8 and 9. And so I felt like I was a little stuck. And like I said, the first thing we had been looking for was fellowship and finding meetings and stuff. And the first meeting we went to was on Friday, October 6th of last year. And the first person that walked up to me and said hello to me was Ginger. And she shared that night at the meeting. Part of what we were talking about in the meeting was about sponsorship and newcomers and how to, you know, and service and those kind of things. And I asked her that night, will you be my sponsor? Because I knew I needed somebody right away before I was afraid I could start to isolate. I was afraid of a lot of things. And she didn't say yes immediately. She said, are you convinced that you have a problem? I said, oh, yeah. And then she was like, all right, well, call me tomorrow at this time. And we moved on from there. But, you know, she has enough experience that she knew the questions to ask and wanted to make sure that I was serious about it and that I was a person that knew what I was getting into with a new sponsor and that we were on the right path together. And it's been a great path. It's been a great path in finishing up the steps. And it was kind of at a weird space in there because there was a lot of backtracking and stuff to do, but it's been amazing so far. And it's been, great getting into doing some more service work like the stuff at the jail and things like that. And like I said, I mean, just the gifts that I've received are more than I could have ever asked for or ever dreamed of. I have a relationship today with somebody who also is in the program, who I can be myself with, who doesn't care, who doesn't want me because of what I have or what I can give or any of that stuff, and who understands that this is, for both of us, it's life and death. You know, this to drink again is to die. I'm 100% convinced of that, and I'm sure everybody in this room has heard somebody say, I mean, I may have another relapse. I doubt very seriously that I have another recovery, and I'm not willing to risk that. Not today. Not today. I'm not willing to risk it. Today, I know that God has helped me to get through this day, and live another sober day. And I want that. I want to keep that. And what that's meant for me, for anybody that is new, for me, that's meant continuing to do my readings on a daily basis, having a home group, having a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a home group, who both have home groups. It means staying in contact with the people in my life who have been there for me. It means me picking up, answering the phone when people call me. It means me not lying anymore. It means me, my family, most of my family lives in Colorado and in New Mexico, and a few in my dad in Florida. It means me picking up the phone when they call and caring about what's going on in their lives and trying to right now, the most important things to me are the people in my life, that, aside from my sobriety. That's the number one thing, because without that, I have nothing. But the people that have been there for me, I want to nourish those. I want to nourish those relationships, and I want to make living amends to those people every day, because I wasted time. And when I look back, I don't have a lot of regrets anymore. I was able, because of this program, because of the people that have helped me with my sponsors and other people who have been there to support me, I have been able to let go of that. I have been able to understand that it's not my fault. My husband's suicide is not my fault. I'm not that powerful. I didn't cause it. I don't determine who lives or dies. And I don't have a lot of regrets. I think I like the person who I'm becoming. But I do regret, the one regret I do have is wasted time. And I don't ever again want to have a feeling of wasted time. I want to try to make every day count and do what I can to try to bring a message and hopefully at some point start sponsoring other people and help them to get what I've got. Because I've gotten a lot of gifts in my life. I grew up as a pretty spoiled, rotten kid, but I never got anything like this. Never anything that meant this. And my family flew down from Colorado last year. David was there for that, to Florida, for my 1 year anniversary at my treatment center. And out of my college degrees, those things, none of that even could compare to how it felt to have them sitting there knowing what it meant. Because I could see that they knew, you know, they knew, and they were just as happy as I was, you know, maybe surprised, and that's fair, you know, that's fair, because God knows I have a lot more years of practice in the bad behavior than I do in anything worthwhile, but I'm working on it, and I know that, you know, I have a lot more humility than I used to, and I know that we do this together, and it's not me, that God is responsible for all of it. I have just one other thing that I wanted to share, which is from the end of this story, because it kind of sums up how I feel today. And it says, every day I feel a little more useful, more happy, and more free. Life, including some ups and downs, is a lot of fun. I'm a part of AA, which is a way of life. If I had not become an active alcoholic and joined AA, I might never have found my own identity or become a part of anything. And ending my story, I like to think about this. And for me, that's true, because this is the best group of people I think I could ever be around, because I do belong here. And I don't belong here because I have to be what I'm not. I can be who I am, and people are okay with that. And you could choose to like me or not like me, but at least it's the real me that you're making that choice about. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that, because it's so much easier than that whole charade that I lived for years and years. And in a step one meeting a few weeks ago, I was trying to think of what step one or what powerlessness felt like for me. And what it felt like for me was like a never-ending roller coaster, like a roller coaster I got on every day, but it was like a roller coaster that it always ended different. Like sometimes you fell out at the top, and sometimes it crashed off the side, and sometimes it went around in curly cues, and it was always it was a rush, but it was a fearful rush, because you didn't know if it was going to crash or maybe it was going to come back in the beginning, but you always got back in that line, boy. Every day you were just back in that line. And that's how I felt, you know. And I don't ever want to have to be in that line again. I want to be happy with and mindful of where I am at every minute, because another day is not promised. And for me, it's important to keep that in mind always, so that I can be, you know, make the most of what I've got and appreciate God and the people in my life that have been there to help me through this journey. So again, I appreciate being able to come out and speak tonight. Thank you very much. And that's all I've got.